Supervisors, please take your seat and log in on your computer. We have 27 members present. That is a quorum. Let's stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Remember George Burns saying, Pledge of Allegiance? So help me, me.
We are going to start with the oath of office by the Honorable Judge Pascal. There is a half sheet sitting on your desk. After you are sworn in, we need you to sign that where it says signature of elected official. We will pass them down, and the judge will then sign them, and they'll be filed in our office. Before you leave tonight, we will make sure you get your oath card that you keep.
All right, everybody raise your right hand. Please stand. I state your name.
I, Jeff Draper.
Having been elected to the office,
having been elected to the office
of County Board Supervisor District, and then state your name.
County Board Supervisor District
49. Swear that I will support the Constitution of the United States.
Swear that I support the Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Wisconsin.
And the Constitution of the State of Wisconsin.
And will faithfully and impartially discharge the duties of said office,
of said office,
to the best of my ability,
to the best of my ability.
So help me God.
So help me God.
You sign them.
We'll take a minute now for you to sign. And then we're going to pass them down so Judge Pascal can then sign them. Everyone's turned in the form? Okay. We will move on to the elections for the chair, first vice chair, and second vice chair. We will do each of these separately. At this point, I will open the floor for nominations for chair. Supervisor Cruz.
I would like to nominate Tara Johnson for county board chair.
Is there a second? Second by Supervisor Friedland. Is there any other nominations for chair? Any other nominations for chair? Third and final nominations for chair. Nominations are closed. You can do this on a voice vote then, since there's only one. Having only one Supervisor Burke?
Madam Chair, I move to cast a unanimous ballot for Tara Johnson for chair.
Seconded by Supervisor Holtz. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? Supervisor Johnson will be the chair. Congratulations, Supervisor Johnson. We will now open the floor for nominations for first vice chair. Supervisor Geary.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. I'd like to nominate Supervisor Vicki Burke.
Is there a second to that? Supervisor Kyle seconds that. Any other nominations for First Vice Chair? Supervisor Doyle.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. I want to make a brief statement as part of my nomination also. We are fortunate to have two very good candidates running for First Vice Chair, and I really do mean that. I'm going to nominate Sharon Hampson for that position based upon if there is a position in the county that is a good training ground for leadership and for one of the officer positions, that would be the chair of the Human Services Board or the Health and Human Services Board. When I was Health and Human Services Board, I think I learned more than I did as county board chair. When I was county board chair, I worked very closely with Tara Johnson, our new chair, who also had the position of Health and Human Services Board Chair. That is a position where you need to be creative, you need to be innovative, you need to be cooperative, and you need to look for solutions. And Sharon has done a really good job in that respect. I think that she would be an excellent first vice chair, and so I so nominate her.
Supervisor Doyle nominates Supervisor Hansen. Is there a second to that? Seconded by Supervisor Karen Johnson. Are there any other nominations for first vice chair? Any other nominations for first vice chair? Third and final, nominations for first vice chair. Nominations are closed. We will hand out ballots. It will be a blank ballot. You can either write down Supervisor Hampson or Supervisor Burke's name. We will then tally the results. We will use the whiteboard to tally the results.
Necessary.
We'll have to start over.
One vote.
Recount.
We don't use that. By a vote of 14-13, Supervisor Hansen has been elected first vice chair. I will now open the floor for nominations for second vice chair. Any nominations for second vice chair? Supervisor Spiker.
Place nomination of second vice chair, Mr. Ray Ebert.
Supervisor Ebert's been nominated. Is there a second? Supervisor Schrader seconds it. Any other nominations for second vice chair? Supervisor Plesha.
Thank you. I'd like to place the name of Joe Veenstra for second vice chair.
Supervisor Plesha nominates Supervisor Veenstra. Is there a second to that? Supervisor Landry. Second set. Any other nominations for second vice chair? Any other nominations for second vice chair? Third and final, any nominations for second vice chair? Nominations are closed. We will distribute the ballots and tally in the same manner.
Somebody's got to be last.
Thank you.
On a vote of 14-13, Supervisor Ebert has been elected second vice chair. At this point, I will turn the meeting over to our County Board Chair, Johnson.
Good evening. Thank you all very much. Welcome to the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors. My congratulations to First Vice Chair Supervisor Hampson and Supervisor Vicki Burke for running for that office, and my congratulations to Supervisor Ray Ebert as second vice chair and his opponent in that race, Supervisor Joe Veenstra. I welcome all of you and hope that those results that just were erased from the board are actually an indication of what awaits us here on the La Crosse County Board, that we have great people wishing to do good work for La Crosse County. And that some of these issues will be close. There'll be some tight races and some tight votes, but know that all of us are here to do the work of the county and do our best work to improve the quality of life for everyone who lives in La Crosse County. So my thanks to all of you and welcome. And with that, I will call on Corporation Counsel Dave Lang under Communications and Announcements to remind us of a couple of matters of code of ethics, open meetings, and the role of corporation counsel. I promise the new supervisors who've been here since 5 o'clock, this will be new stuff that Dave is talking about.
Good evening. I'm Dave Lane. I'm the corporation counsel. We're going to be talking about a couple of issues, and I hope I can try to make this as interesting as I can. There's just going to be a brief exam when this is over. And Jenny, do you have that ready? Do you? Yeah. Okay. No, the exam. we'll talk about code of ethics, and I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. But these situations do come up, and frankly, I don't expect us to get the answers to every question you'd have by going through this. But what I want to do is make sure that you have an understanding of some of the things that we deal with, some of the questions that may come up, so at least you are alerted to thinking this may be a situation that I need to deal with, or it may be a situation where there is a conflict. So at least you have some idea of what's a problem, and some idea of when you may want to speak with me or someone else about whether there's an issue here. So I will go through that. I'm not going to go into great detail. I will say this, that sometimes our office is sort of like the Grinch. You know, we're the ones that say, you know, people say, well, can I just get this? And we're the ones that say, no, I don't think that's a good idea. So oftentimes I feel like I'm Mr. No, telling you can't do something. But it is important that we deal with these issues as they come up. So you want to go to the first screen? Our ethics laws, we're basically governed by about three different laws, and one is a state statute, the Code of Ethics for Local Governmental Officials. The second is a state statute, a criminal statute, private interest in public contracts, which I want to touch on because it's one you really want to stay away from. And the third is our Code of Ethics, which governs all employees and officials in the county. And that's probably the one that would be the one that applies in the vast majority of cases to you and to other employees in the county. Next slide, please. This is the statute, 19.59, and it deals with state officials, but it also deals with local public officials. And it applies to people holding elective office, such as yourselves, or the county treasurer, register of deeds, or the county clerk. It applies to the county administrator. It applies to individuals holding an appointive office, ones holding the point of office for which is filled by the governing body or the county administrator, such as certain department heads. They're also governed by this. It's not for all the employees, but it's for the officials of the county or of other local governmental bodies. So they are governed by the state statute. Next slide, please. Basically, what the statute does is it prohibits a certain conduct, and I'll go into just a little more detail in the next slides, but one is using your office for private gain, shouldn't do that, offer or receipt of anything of value, this is something that's also covered under our local code of ethics, actions that affect a substantial financial interest or benefit, Again, that's also in our code of ethics. Use of office to advance a substantial interest or benefit to self or immediate family. What I want to point out here is that in the state statute, that's mostly just defined as spouse and dependents, those who rely upon you or your spouse for at least 50% of their livelihood. In the county, in our code of ethics, immediate family is much broader. It includes aunts and uncles, parents, nieces, nephews, brothers, sisters. So immediate family is much broader. So you have to think about that if you think, is there an issue here, or do I have a financial interest in something? It's not just you, and it's not just your kids. It could be brothers or sisters and aunts and uncles. So that's one thing to consider. But at least for the state law, it's for immediate dependents. Next slide, please. Now, you may accept, this is more the positive, this is things you can do. You can obtain items and services unrelated to your public position. Now normally, if you're going to be offered things, it's going to be because of your position, but sometimes it's not. It's not related to your position. So in that case, it's okay. And it may be expenses provided by or for the benefit of a local government unit, such as the county. Let me give you an example, because this will come up also in the county code of ethics. Maybe we're having an in-service that's provided by a provider, and they're giving us some education on a topic, and they offer to buy pizza to come in. And you say, well, I don't know if I should take the pizza because they're buying it. Well, the thing is, it's not really for your benefit because you're not going to pay for it anyway. The county is going to pay for it because it's during this training, and if the training goes from 10 to 4, and you're going to get a lunch, and if the lunch would be provided by the county, then it's not something that's for your benefit, it's for the government benefit, so it's not an issue. Or it might be maybe items of insubstantial value. People debate about that all the time, but you know if it's a pen or a pad or things like that, it's not an issue. You start getting above $5 to $10, then you're getting it where it's more of an issue. Next slide, please. Local public officials should not accept items or services offered because of your public position. Items that could influence your judgment or your vote. Some of this is common sense. You got to take a look at it and say, is this why it's being offered? Is it a reward for an official action? Does it involve you or an official taking action or using your office in a way that will produce a substantial benefit, either directly or indirectly, to yourself or your immediate family? If it's one of those things, and you should not accept it, and it would violate the state code. And likely these would also violate our local code also. Next slide, please. This is the second area this is the criminal statute, section 946.13. And this one's a little bit hard to read, but what it does is this one recognizes two types of conflicts. It restricts the conduct of public officials acting in their private capacity with public contracts, and also official capacity. So this regulates the conduct of public officials who have a direct or indirect private financial interest in public contracts entered into by the government entity for whom they serve. Next slide. I'll go into this in a little more detail. Okay, what do we mean by in one's private capacity? It means you have a direct or indirect private financial interest in a public contract, and you are involved in negotiating the bidding or entering into the contract in your private capacity. In other words, you're not wearing your county hat, you're wearing your private hat. And you're involved, and you decide, I want to enter into this contract, or maybe it's your spouse, and they're involved in actually entering into a private contract with the county. And in your private capacity, you become involved in it. And we'll see as we go through the slides why that can be an issue. Next slide, please. So you're involved in negotiating this in your private capacity, but on the other hand, you're authorized, required by law, to participate in making the contract or performing some official function in the exercise of discretion. In other words, maybe you're voting on it. It's an exercise of discretion. So you can't do both at the same time. But the real kicker is in the next slide. Well, maybe it's not the next, it's the slide after this. Okay. It does get a little bit complicated, and that's why I thought, sometimes when I read it, I have trouble understanding all the nuances of this. But this just goes from the other side, saying, if you're in the public official, you're not involved in negotiating or bidding on it, But you're a public official. You're prohibited from participating in making that contract in which you have a direct or indirect financial interest, and you're prohibited from having any kind of discretionary involvement in that contract. Now, the next slide gives the kicker, which is there's a dollar amount. It's contracts in which any single public officer is private interested that involve receipts or disbursements of more than $15,000. So it's less than $15,000, you don't have to worry. So the only thing I want you to take from this is that if you're involved in a contract where you or your immediate family can obtain $15,000 a year in a private contract with the county, you have to be very careful, because this is a strict liability statute. It means we don't care what your intent was. You may have been totally honest in what you're doing, and you didn't intend to have this conflict, but you do it, it's a felony. Next slide, please. And the felony is, it's a Class 1 felony with fines of not more than $10,000 and imprisonment not more than 2 years. Again, no proof of criminal intent. So you want to stay away from this situation. And that's all I want you to take from this, is if you're involved in something where you have a benefit of $15,000 or more, you want to stay away from it. You don't want to be involved in bidding it, and you don't want to be involved where you have the authority to act on that contract in any way. So, and if you have any question about a situation like this, please talk to me or talk to our office. Yes, Steve.
Just a clarification, you made the comment, if it's under $15,000, don't have to worry, but you're not going to get convicted of a felony, but you still may be in violation of the ethics code.
Right, so right.
If you have,
you don't have to worry about this statute.
Yeah, if you have any sort of business dealings, talk to Dave before you do anything.
Right. Thanks, Steve, for that point. Because when I said not to worry, it's not to worry about this felony statute, but it's still a problem because it's still a conflict of interest. So you still don't want to do it. So that clarification is still an issue. But if it's over $15,000, you really have to worry because you've got this strict liability felony statute. So that's why I wanted to bring this to your attention. Next slide, please. Then we have our La Crosse County Code of Ethics, and the vast majority of our cases deal with this, the Code of Ethics. And it is important because we take an oath to uphold the Constitution, we take an oath to uphold the state constitution, and we want to do things in a way which are ethically right, they're fair, and we don't have a problem of having financial gain. In other words, we want to have clean government. So our declaration of policy is to be independent and impartial, responsible to the public. We want to make decisions according to proper procedures. We will not use our offices for personal or financial gain. And we will conduct our business in a manner that instills public confidence. And those are all laudable goals, and those are ones that we should follow. Next slide, please. So to establish ethical standards of conduct for all La Crosse County officials and employees, we have this code of ethics. And in this, I say coverage, and the reason I said coverage under this slide is because this code applies to elected officials, it applies to members of all of our committees and the La Crosse County Board, it applies to all employees. So basically, it applies to all the employees, all the committee members, all the boards and commissions, and the County Board of Supervisors. So it's pretty inclusive. Now, you do have a right to engage in professional and business activities. Many of you are going to be involved in businesses. You can maintain investments and activities as long as they do not conflict with specific provisions of this code. Next slide, please. There's really two issues that arise in our code of ethics, and this is one of them, fair and equal treatment. The other is conflict of interest that you hear about. But fair and equal treatment means we have county property, and I should put it up there, county services, and they should not be used for unauthorized non-governmental purposes, should not be used for unauthorized personal convenience or profit. In other words, no special consideration or treatment unless the services or use are available to the general public. Well, what are some examples? Well, for instance, you just can't go use a county personal vehicle to go down to a Badger game or something like that. When it's not your personal vehicle, you can't go using a county ATV from the highway department to go hunting. You can't have certain services say, you know, IT services, I got a problem with my computer at home. Could you come and just take a look at it? Just take a second. I mean, those are just some of them. They sound kind of humorous, but that's the point. You can't be using your special position to obtain a use of county property and county services that the general public wouldn't have. So it's somewhat, sort of common sense, but sometimes it's violated. So it's good just to be reminded. County services and property should just be used for governmental business. Next slide, please. Conflict of interest is the issue that comes up a lot. And, it's not always simple what's a conflict of interest. These are the different areas that I'm just going to talk about. Receipt of gifts or gratuities or preferential treatment is prohibited. Business interests can create a conflict. Your employment can create a conflict. Contracting that we've already discussed. Financial interest in legislation and disclosure of privileged information. Those are the types that are addressed in our code. Next slide, please. Receipt of gifts. This is the one that comes up quite often. I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. These are two situations that have come up in the past with the county board. We had a situation where one of the local financial establishments had received approval from the board of some county services, and they were thankful for what happened. And they basically indicated that they were inviting the people involved out to lunch. And the question came to our office, should we accept that? And frankly, we said no, because the county's not going to benefit. It wasn't during the county situation where the county we would have reimbursed for it. It was for a private benefit, and it looked like a reward for business. Even if it wasn't, it would look like it was a reward for business granted. So we basically said, don't do it. Had another situation where there was a gift situation, a commemorative gift. One of the local businesses had been involved in a situation where county officials had done a lot of work for this organization, and they were successful partly because of that work, and they wanted to give us something. So this sounded real good. And it was a commemorative gift. The value was $13. It was basically saying thanks, giving you a gift, and unfortunately, we had to say, you can't receive it unless you pay for it. So it was either no or pay for the value. Again, we were like the Grinch saying, sorry, but can't do it. But because they didn't do it for business in the future. They did it because they were thankful for what had been done. And this will happen sometimes. But it basically did look like a reward for work that was done. It was more than just inconsequential value. It was connected to your position, the position of work we had done, so we said no. But those are the situations that come up, things like that. So you should not solicit or accept anything of value that's an unsolicited gift or gratuity unless it's of insignificant value, and anything given independent of your position as an official or employee is also okay. But oftentimes they are connected to your position as an official. Next slide, please. Did I go?
She's a step ahead of
me. Oh, yeah, step ahead of me. Okay. Business interest. No official or employee shall not engage in any financial transaction which is incompatible with the discharge of your duties, is contrary to this code, or may impair independence of judgment or action in your duties. In other words, if you are engaged in any financial transaction which is incompatible with what you're doing, in other words, I couldn't engage in a financial transaction which was totally incompatible with my duty as corporation counsel. I couldn't start doing work in employment or have a business interest where I could be doing work against the county. That would clearly be a violation of the code. The last one is something that comes up sometimes. Does it impair your independence of judgment? If you were on this board, would it impair your independence of judgment in acting on or voting on a situation? And often what you're going to have to do when those come up is you basically just have to abstain from discussion and abstain from voting. And if you have a question about something like that, you can always ask our office for advice. The next slide, please. Employment is similar. An official employee shall not engage in private employment when the employment is incompatible with your duties or impairs your independence of judgment. And again, that would be for if you have some employment that's incompatible with what your duty is here on the board, or it would impair your independence of judgment because there's a conflict somehow. Some situations that have come up are, I was just looking at some examples at least even from the state, kind of, there was a situation that came up at the state where a person represented a town. The town chair was an employee of a company, and the company was owned by a different individual, and the company also owned another company which contracted with the town, and so the question came up, well, the town chair, should the town chair be involved with it? And it ended up with the advice being that the town chair should just not be involved in those decisions, because even though it was this other contract that this company was involved in that he was employed with, their action in that company B could affect the employment of this individual. Was that significant? So in that case, they said he should stay out of it. There was another situation where someone asked for an opinion, and for it was a village board, but because no matter what the village did, it wasn't going to really impact how this company did, whether they would stay in the area, whether they'd keep employing the same individuals. In other words, it was very remote whether it would have any impact on his employment, and it was still okay to then act on it. So these are case-by-case situations. They're not always easy. We have to go through an analysis and analyze it. So part of the reason to go through this is to basically tell you that these things do get somewhat complicated, and you have to go through this analysis, but at least you have some idea of thinking about when could there be a conflict. Next slide, please. Contracting. I guess we've gone over this, but it involves, you know about the state statute, the criminal statute, but in our code it says if there's receipt of more than $2,000 in a 12-month period, and I believe that's by yourself or your immediate family, that requires written disclosure to the county clerk if you hold over a 10% or greater interest, or if you get more than $2,000 in that period. You're supposed to disclose that to the county clerk so that they know that that situation is arising. We've had that happen. Didn't seem to be a big conflict where we've had an employee did have slightly more than $2,000, disclosed that fact. It was disclosed so the county board knew about it and approved it in that situation. But again, at least you know what the situation is, so you can either approve it or not approve it. Next slide, please. Financial interest in legislation. If you or an employee has a financial interest in legislation before this board, it must be disclosed to the clerk and the county board, so at least we're aware that it's there. And then if you do have a financial interest, you should abstain from speaking on the issue and from voting on the action. It's kind of common sense, but it's just something that you should do. I mean, if you have an interest, whether it's a zoning issue, you may have an interest because you're voting directly on your situation. If it's a contract that you directly have a financial interest in, maybe you're employed by a situation where it's coming up for a vote to approve that contract, then you should abstain and not vote on it. And if you have a question about it, again, give our office a call, talk to us about it. We may have to go through an analysis on it. It may be a conflict, it may not. Next slide, please. Financial interest includes yielding any monetary or other material benefit to an employee or your immediate family. And as I indicated before, immediate family is very broad in our code of ethics. It includes a spouse, parents, children, brothers, sisters, aunts and uncles, nephews. Next slide, please. So what questions should you ask if you're offered items or services? This goes back to being offered items or services. Is it being offered because of my position? Is it of more than nominal or insignificant value? Is it primarily for my personal benefit or for the local government? And if you answered yes to all of them, you may not accept the item or the service. And that's the same analysis that I would go through if you came to me with that question. Next slide, please. I guess that's the other question. Would it be reasonable for someone to believe that the item or service is likely to influence my judgment or that it is reward for past action? It's another question to ask. So, and the last slide is, if you have any questions, please let me know.
Any questions of Dave?
Okay.
You're on a roll.
All right. Next issue. The next slide is open meetings and public records law. Okay. How are we doing? Is everybody still awake? All right. I'll try to make this a little more interesting. Again, this is an overview. It's not intended to go into detail, but I just wanted to go in an overview, and I'll try to go through this fairly quickly. Open meetings law. First, we have to know what a meeting is. It occurs when there's two requirements. There's a purpose to engage in any governmental business, and this is interpreted fairly broadly. It can be just going for information. It's any governmental business, and where it's the number of members are sufficient to determine the course of action. Why does it say determine the course of action? Why doesn't it just say a quorum? That's because it can be a majority and it may not be. If the item that's being talked about is something where it requires a supermajority or a two-thirds, it may be just a little over one-third is a problem, because that a little over one-third can determine the course of action. It can defeat the measure. So you have to be a little bit careful. The vast majority of time, it's a majority, but not always. Next slide, please. Communication by email, and I guess this is something we're going to be talking about a lot when we talk about the meetings, because we're in a new world. A couple of years ago when we read this, over 87% of all written communications are email. I believe it's probably more now. You know, in 2002, there were 3.25 trillion emails generated by U.S. businesses. Who knows what it is now? It's got to be a huge amount if I look at my emails. Emails are sometimes like correspondence, which may be a public record. Sometimes they're like conversation. That can still trigger provisions of open meetings. That's just the way it is used these days. But we have to remember that these are going to be often considered records. Next slide. Email and instant messaging, even texting, may have enough of the aspects of a discussion to be considered a meeting. And that's why I wanted to talk about this, because the necessary ingredient for a violation of the open meetings law is just that there is enough communication between a sufficient number of members on a governmental issue. And the purpose of this is you do not want to be reaching an agreement outside of the public meeting arena. Next slide, please. Okay, a simple majority of members is presumed to be a meeting. Exception, what about a walking quorum? What's a walking quorum? It's a series of gatherings among separate groups of members of a governmental body, each less than a quorum, who agree to act uniformly in sufficient number to reach a quorum. Why do we have to watch out for this? Because when you have emails, you can have a number of people who aren't talking at one time, who may not be a majority, but they can forward it on and talk to other board members or other committee members and reach an agreement without ever talking at one time with a majority number of people and still reach a consensus and have a discussion. So you have to be careful about that. Next slide. Walking quorum. If it looks like you have an attempt to reach an agreement outside the meeting, it's likely considered a violation of the open meetings law. And this can happen, especially in this day and age of email. So that's why I caution to be very careful about this. Next slide. The Attorney General's caution is, don't use it. Caution is against using email as an instant messaging as a means of communication when it's used to carry on private debate and discussions of public business. You know, it can be okay to just say, hey, we're meeting at 2 o'clock tomorrow instead of 1 o'clock. We're going to have on the agenda this item. But, you know, it gets real easy sometimes to just start talking about the issue. And if you start talking about the issue and you get enough people involved in the emails, even if it's just you and so-and-so are doing it, or, you know, Joe and Roger Plesher get involved in a discussion and Roger forwards it to someone else and they say, yeah, I think you're right, that is a problem. And then they reply to everybody and they get five members on a committee of nine, and they seem to have reached an agreement, it's a violation of the open meetings law. Next slide, please. What can you do to reduce the risk of violating it? Just don't click reply to all and forward all the time. Just respond only to the originator. That's one way. Don't keep up a series of back and forth emails. Don't have a discussion going on back and forth. Next slide. Okay, so I think I hit enough on the emails. I just want to touch briefly on the requirements for open meetings, because a lot of you may know all of this already, but I think we just need to be reminded. Open meetings, we need advance public notice. We need to conduct all business in open session unless an exemption to the open session specifically applies, because we know the strong public policy in the state is open meetings. Meetings should be open to the public, And closed sessions should only be held when it strictly meets those exceptions. Meetings have to be held in places that are accessible to members of the public. We get involved in this when we know there's going to be a lot of people at a meeting, and we know this place isn't going to hold it. So we have to find a place that can be accessible to members of the public so that they can participate and be there. Next slide, please. Contents. Oftentimes our office gets involved with this. It has to give the time, place, and subject matter. You have to include what's intended for consideration at the closed session. And you have to do it in a form that's reasonably likely to apprise the members of the public and news media of what you're going to be talking about. Next slide, please. So how specific does it have to be? There's some court cases that deal with this, and they've been helping us as far as guiding us. And one is, it's a case by case. You can't, it's what's reasonable. And the rule of thumb is, you have to ask yourself whether a person interested in the subject would be aware, if they read it, that the subject might be discussed. That's kind of the rule of thumb. If you read it and you go, I have no idea what you're going to be talking about, or it's way too general, it's probably not specific enough. I used to see this sometimes. I remember traveling around. I would see, not that long ago, there would be examples of, we're just going to put such other matters as authorized by law, and they just start talking about stuff. I thought, or old business or new business, and just start talking about different items. It's okay to say, we need to deal with this, we'll talk about it on our next meeting, but you can't go on and start and talk about a topic and take action on a topic unless you give some notice of what it's going to be. And even in closed session, you've got to give some idea of what the topic is. You can't just basically indicate some very general thing so people don't know what you're going to be talking about. And that's a case-by-case issue, too. I know there was a case in Toma, and it involved a collective bargaining agreement, and it was also a case that people were very hot about. There was a lot of discussion about it. The notice barely had some very generic statement on the issue, and the court said not good enough. They said, one thing you have to look at is, if this is something that people are really interested in, they know what it's about. If you put in contract regarding this, they're going to know what it is. And the way it was noticed, they wouldn't even know what they were talking about. So they said, that's not good enough. Next slide, please. So closed session, when is it permissible? One is, the notice must contain what it's going to be about. It must be invoked sparingly and only used where the exemptions apply. And this is one that's not always followed, but the closed session requires a motion which must state the specific statutory exemption and must state the nature of the business to be discussed. So in other words, when you make a motion to go into closed session, don't just say, pursuant to 19.85, parent 1, parent B. What you're supposed to do is say, motion to go into closed session pursuant to 19.85, parent whatever the specific parent is, to go into closed session and consult with legal counsel regarding a matter that we're involved in, to wit, so-and-so industries or so-and-so, whoever brought the suit. So they know what it is. But anyway, you're supposed to announce that when you go into closed session. Next slide. So just a very general overview of the public notice law. The public records law, and I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. The policy is, again, to provide people with the greatest public information regarding the affairs of government. And so we have a public records law that is to make those records available to the public. Next slide. And the reason I'm going over this is because I want to make sure it's clear that the emails that you may be involved in are also records. Because records include every form of information kept by an authority. It includes electronically created and stored data. It includes emails, floppy disks, hard drives. And those are things which, if you're involved in county business and using email, those are also considered public records if they're used in governmental business. Next slide. Any person may inspect a public record, subject to certain exceptions. The motivation is immaterial. I often have questions that a person says, well, I know they're just getting this to get after me, or I know they're just getting this information because they want to make it look bad. I think it doesn't matter. The person has a right to access to public records. Next slide. Email messages are public records if they're made in or received in connection with governmental business. There was a recent court case, Schill versus Wisconsin Rapids in 2010, and I'm glad it clarified this, but personal emails are not public records because they fall under an exception in the law of drafts or notes or materials prepared for personal use. The problem is when we get an email request, we will sometimes have situations where the personal is mixed in with the governmental. So what do we have to do? Go in and redact and look at everyone? That can be an issue. You should try to keep your emails as separate as possible. This is what I use for governmental business. And personal, if you're going to do some personal stuff on it, just keep it at a minimum and keep it personal. But try to keep them separate because personal emails aren't public. You know, I'm going to let's meet afterwards and do this. See you to play ball the next night. But the governmental business is a public record. And they're also subject to records retention. Next slide, please. So, documents that are subject to requests for inspection if they're involved with governmental business, including emails that you have, I have, may not be destroyed. They need to be stored in a way that allows access. Now, I'm not sure how we're doing in the county now. I've talked to John Parshall about this. Supervisors are encouraged to use the county email address for county business because it does ensure that there's record retention. Even if you delete it, they're always kept. There's always a backup kept. So even if you delete it, those records are available. Whereas if you use your own private, you can forward all those emails to the county email address, but it just doesn't guarantee it, and it's not a really efficient way. So I would encourage you to use the county email address. Thanks a lot, Jim. Any questions?
Any questions of Dave on that?
I'm sorry, am I taking
last
too much?
You don't want me to answer that, Dave. You don't think you want me to answer that. But last item is role of corporation counsel.
All right. I'll make this short because I think you've heard from me enough already. But it does give me a brief way to tell you what is our role as corporation counsel. Couple of things. We provide legal opinions to the county board. We provide legal opinions to its committees. We interpret the powers and duties of the board. So if you have questions about that, we're available for that. We provide legal advice to all county departments. We represent the county in all civil matters in which the county is interested, includes county claims, contract disputes. We do a lot of work for Human Services, and if I could just say this very briefly, there's a deputy corporation counsel, Megan DeVore, and Amy Flottmeyer is an assistant corporation counsel. A lot of our work is doing human service court work. We do all the child in need of protection cases for children in need of protection. We do termination of parental rights cases. Those cases are very time-consuming. We do the Chapter 51 mental commitments and alcohol commitments in the county. We do the Chapter 54 and 55 cases, which are the guardianship and placement. You wonder, why do we get involved in those? Well, there are many cases where people don't have attorneys. There are many emergency cases involving those, and we're involved in many of those cases. We do the child support enforcement and do all the court cases for the child support agency. We represent the child support agency. We prepare the resolutions and all ordinances. We're not the only ones to prepare resolutions, but we do that. We prepare all of the ordinances and analysis. Our role is to represent the county and not individual supervisors. I'm certainly, you know, our office will prepare resolutions at your request and ordinances at your request, unless we feel that it's not legal. And if it's not a legal resolution or not a legal ordinance, we will tell you that. And there may also be times where there's a situation that involves maybe it's an ethics complaint or something like that, where our office may be representing the ethics board and not you as an individual counselor. So our role is to represent the county and not individual supervisors. So I just want to talk briefly about that. So that's the end of my presentation. Thanks for listening.
Supervisor Burns has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lang, you mentioned closed meeting laws, and my question is this. Can a supervisor, an individual supervisor, request a closed meeting if it's pursuant to the statutes that you cited? Because there has been a number of times, I think, where the question is, we can go into closed session, but for whatever reason, it's not cited as closed session. So is it in our purview to request a closed session if it does follow the statutes that you cited?
I think you could come up ahead of time and ask and say, I think this should be in closed session, but then I would have to, you know, tell you whether I thought it could be or not.
And then, so is that the process then? We just ask you, and then I guess I... We don't have to have the answer tonight, but that's something I would like to get more information about.
Yeah, because normally it's in the, it has to be noticed for it, but so it'd be more in the agenda setting with the committee chair. So normally, I'm not sure how the communication would be, but either you would be communicating with the committee chair saying, I'd like to do this in closed session. Can we talk about that in closed session? And then we talk about that in the agenda setting. And then I think the committee chair or Steve O'Malley or someone would come to me and say, here's this item. Can we do it in closed session? And then I basically have to look at that.
Okay, so it's not something that we don't have to vote on that decision. That we can just request that.
Yeah, it's not a vote.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Supervisor Geary, did you have a comment?
Well, that was my point. It has to be noticed. So if it isn't noticed, it'd have to be held over to the subsequent meeting, and then Corporation Council would determine if it met the requirements of closed session, even if versus open session.
Any other questions for Dave Lang, Corporation Council? If not, thank you very much, Dave, for covering
a
lot of
thank you for listening.
Scintillating information in a brief period of time. Now, County Clerk report.
I promise mine will be a lot quicker. Amy's handing out your oath cards. The top line is for you to sign, and then this card is for you to keep.
That's it?
No. On your desk, there's this packet. It has the county public directory information. I need you to please fill that out tonight and turn it in. If you're a new supervisor, we handed out a sheet to you that had your new county email address. It's highly preferred that you use that. If you don't want to, that's your choice. If you want to provide another email address to use, fill it out, please. Let us know if there's an additional phone number you want to use, a cell phone number. This information will be posted on the website and printed in the directory that's distributed to the public. So only put information here that you want the public to receive. The next form is the Code of Ethics, and Dave just went through that very clearly. Even if there is nothing you need to fill out here, please sign and date the bottom, and make sure you turn that in tonight, along with your conflict of interest sheet. Those need to be turned in tonight before you leave. If there's a question you have on something, you need to talk to Dave, that's fine, but get them to us as soon as possible. The auditors are coming, and they do look to make sure we have one from each supervisor. If you have not already, your committee preference form, I think we only have three or four that need to be turned in. Please turn that in before you leave tonight. I believe at the county board retreat next week, committees will be informed. You'll be informed of what committee you'll be on. So make sure we get that in tonight so you're on the committees that you prefer. And we'll discuss the vehicle insurance requirements at next month's meeting when we go over expense reports. Ethics conflict project. The only other thing I can request is the envelope you get your packet information in. After you take your packet information out, don't throw these away. Please turn them back in so we can reuse them. It's a way to save money. It's a way to be green, recycle. So if you don't need them, please turn them back into our office and we can reuse them.
Supervisor Veenstra.
Thanks. This is a little bit of a flashback from Dave. I had a question about the emails. If we use the county email, will the county automatically retain them for us?
Yep.
Okay, cool.
Is that it for you? Supervisor Friedland.
I was just pointing out that there's a recycling bin in the corner over there, and there's one in that room also.
And encouraging people to use them. Great, thank you. Supervisor Geary.
Is the clerk done with this?
I believe so.
I think we should take like a 5-minute break, have everybody fill them out so she gets them now so we don't have some kind of chaotic thing at the end. And if somebody's got a question, Dave could clarify it. So that way we could get a break and turn in our paperwork now to make sure it gets
so in. So Supervisor Geary's making a motion to recess for
10 minutes.
Is there a second? Seconded by Supervisor Berg. All those in favor signify by saying
aye.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Oh, it's going to be a good night. On the computer to recess for 10 minutes, practicing our new voting system. If you're in favor of recessing for 10 minutes to complete the forms. Well, I don't care what you do during the recess, actually. If you're in favor of recessing for 10 minutes, vote yes. If you are opposed, vote no. Patient, it'll come up on the screen. Yeah. Supervisor Doyle, you do not get to vote. Sorry. Supervisor Ebert, have you cast your vote? Try again, please. Toughest vote tonight. It ends on a tie. We will continue with item C under communications and announcement, which is the County Board Chair Report. My first item is 4-5, which is to consider a monthly meeting time. A chair would entertain a motion to meet at 6 p.m. on the third Thursday of the month. Moved by Supervisor Cruz, seconded by Supervisor Berg. Discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Our regular meeting time will be 6 p.m. on the third Thursday of the month, except for November, actually, which is. But that will be our regular meeting time is 6 p.m. on our meeting day. Business cards and letterhead are available to be printed in the print shop that has some other name that escapes me right now that has to do with documents and graphic services. Sorry. Mike McGuire is the director of that service for La Crosse County. You might want to write down this phone number. Mike McGuire's phone number is 785-9754. If you're interested in ordering business cards or letterhead at your own expense, I know that Mike will be happy to help you with that. And are there any supervisors who have conference reports or announcements for us this evening? Just for new supervisors, this is an opportunity for supervisors who attend on behalf of the county meetings, conferences, continuing education opportunities to report back to the full board so that everyone can learn from that experience that the supervisor had. Supervisor Brockmiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the second part of that. It's not a conference report. It's an announcement. I wanted to highlight that on Wednesday, May 2nd, from 9 to 12:30, at the La Crosse Public Library main branch, there's going to be a seminar called Staying Open for Business and Hazard Planning for Businesses. It's co-sponsored by the Mississippi Valley Labor Management Council, our La Crosse County Department of Health, and the Bureau of Mediation Services with the state of Minnesota. And I have some registration forms if anyone's interested in attending. The cost is phenomenal. It's free, and it's a 3.5-hour workshop. And like I said, I have sign-up forms if anyone's interested in attending that or more information.
Thank you, Supervisor Brockmiller. Other conference reports or announcements? Seeing none, Administrator O'Malley.
There should be a sign-up sheet going around on the county board retreat. It will be next Tuesday across the street here at the Lunda Center. The sign-up sheet asks you to indicate if you're coming or not and if you're staying for lunch. We do this either once every year or once every 2 years as kind of setting the stage for the term. We will be from 8:30 to noon, and then we'll break for lunch at the Lunda Center. Be very interesting with goal setting, some interactive processes. We start out with an outside speaker, Tom Thibodeau from Viterbo, on servant leadership. I don't know how many of you are aware of some of the concepts of servant leadership, but many local businesses as well as your own employees are are being engaged in what does it mean to be of service, and it's a very interesting presentation. He's very entertaining, and it's a good way to kind of set the stage as we think about this next two-year term. So please make sure you give us an indication if you're able to be there and if you're able to stay for lunch. Some department heads will also be there. It's next Tuesday, the 24th, from 8:30 to noon. It's circulating right now. Yep. Any questions on that? The county board photo, our official county board photographer has asked to move that group photo from what I've listed on the agenda to accomplish that in May. Are people available at the next county board meeting, May 17th, to do a group photo? We have a couple supervisors that are missing that tonight, obviously, that I believe will be back. Does that work for folks? So disregard what's in your agenda. It will be May 17th. Whatever you'd like to be preserved in posterity, along with the rest of your colleagues from past boards back there, address Roger. Comments?
Supervisor Plesha.
I'm sorry.
No, I could. he
pointed.
I was
me.
Just
I'm
thinking
sorry.
That when June starts, people start taking vacations, and we may miss someone. So May is probably a better month. Thanks.
Back to you, Mr. O'Malley.
Yes, ma'am. Future agendas and ongoing board education. Each of you have the one-pager. I talked about this with new supervisors, but we indicate some of the upcoming topics for policy planning. These may change with your input, but the suggestions that we're making are that in May, our policy planning meeting would actually be at the Solid Waste Department. We would do a tour. We get an interaction with the new gas-to-energy project. You can see a whole lot of what's going on there. Not a lot of huge decisions budgetarily, but it's a good orientation for those of you that haven't been on the board before or not on Solid Waste and really involved in either the Policy Board or Public Works. An amazing operation, a lot to be proud of, and I know Hank and his folks would like to show a few things off, so that'll be the first night. And then I'm suggesting the next three policy planning meetings would end up dealing with a lot of the orientation to the major capital issues that we've got. Facilities and this building, highway department would actually be on site at the highway department and getting an orientation with Ron and his staff to a lot of the major highway challenges we have coming over the next several years. And then finally in August is a site visit to Lakeview. We're going to try to fit in another site visit at some point to Hillview. Not as many large financial decisions that will be made, but it would be good to have as part of board education, having us get out of just this meeting room and actually see some of the larger operation. I'm going to try to, in the retreat, do a brief overview very quickly of the budget summary, and I forgot to highlight that to the new board members. We gave you, in the summary format, the current 2012 budget. When we do budget deliberation, you will actually get a full set of line items. And so when we do that for the fall, you'll end up getting this massive document, and that will be part of your deliberation. But just as you're orienting yourself as a new board member, this kind of summarizes the budget decisions that were made by the previous board that have set the stage. Last couple of items, then, in your packet for board education are things like the WCA district meetings. There is one coming up for the La Crosse area on the 26th. If you're interested, Thursday, April 26th, contact either Margaret in the chair's office or the county clerk. And then in addition to that, our local government center, UW Extension, puts together county officials workshops. There's nothing exactly close, but I think Eau Claire is probably the closest. That's in May. So if you're interested in either one of those training sessions that are coming up for your own edification, work with the board chair. The board chair is the one that's responsible for managing your budget as far as what items you can go to and that type of thing. WCA, of course, does not have a cost in this case. The local government center does. You gain approval through her and sometimes carpool and that type of thing. Finally, just to remind you, for both new members and continuing members, we always end with future agenda items, so I just repeat that a couple times. We try to make sure that the agendas for committees and otherwise are responsive to what you want to be talking about, what you want information about, and we'll do a little bit more of that at the retreat as well. I'm hoping that we can actually do some input from committees at that meeting if we have all supervisors there setting the stage for the next two-year term. Madam Chair, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. O'Malley. Just as a follow-up, in May we will be walking through the travel policies, the forms, the procedures. If you are interested in either of those two training opportunities that Mr. O'Malley spoke about, there you need to be pre-approved for incurring any expense to go to training conferences, any continuing ed, and that needs to happen through the County Board Chair's office. So we'll go through the details of those procedures in May. If something comes up between now and when we cover that in May, you can either contact me directly or Margaret up in the chair's office. So just make sure you know that you need to get prior approval before incurring any expenses. And with that, note that there are other cards and correspondence on the back bulletin board. You might want to just take a glance at that when you come in or leave the meetings. Any official correspondence to the board for public posting will appear over on that bulletin board on a regular basis. I don't believe there are any meetings to be held. So with that, I'll call on Supervisor Hampson to take the chair for appointments, please. Supervisor Johnson. Thank you, Supervisor Hampson. I note from the agenda that there are nine appointments to be made and would just draw the attention of first-time supervisors. This would be a regularly occurring agenda item, especially in the April and May, early spring months. There are a lot of appointments to be made that include any of the commissions or special committees where the county board approval is needed to make appointments. So the nine that are listed in the agenda, I would move their approval.
It's been moved that those nine appointments be made. Is there a second? Tina Wu seconds. Any discussion on those appointments? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. Is that it?
Thank you, Supervisor Hampson. Consent agenda, moved by Supervisor Plesha, seconded by Supervisor Brockmiller to approve the consent agenda. Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The consent agenda is approved. Executive Committee, Supervisor Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Item 4-16. This is the second reading, so I move an ordinance to amend Section 3.07, Parent 1 and Parent 2 of Chapter 3 of the General Code of La Crosse County, Wisconsin, regarding work hours.
It's been moved by Supervisor Burke to approve the ordinance. Section 3.07, Parent 1 and Parent 2. Is there a second? Seconded by Supervisor Friedland. Discussion on the ordinance. Supervisor Schrader, is your hand up? Supervisor Schrader.
Thank you. Am I getting this right? This is Ordinance 98 or?
Ordinance 104, I believe.
Oh, I was thinking about the next one. Thank you.
Any discussion on Ordinance 104? Supervisor Geary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This changes the work hours from 8:30 to 5 that we currently have to 8 to 4:30, correct?
Correct.
I think this is an inconvenience for people that are working first shift. If you're working second shift, third shift, or retired, 8:30 to 5 is insignificant. But if you're working days, you, by moving the closing hours to 4:30, I think it'll be an inconvenience for some people. So I oppose changing the work hours. I think they're fine as is, and I think we're supposed to serve the public and be convenient for them.
I'm going to ask that Mr. Ingvaldson be heard on this as the lead staff person who has been working on this issue to give some background.
At the request of the executive committee, we did conduct a survey of the departments that, for the downtown campus here. We wanted to know the number of telephone calls and a number of customer visits from 4:30 to 5 at the respective departments. For the three out of the four that had the highest count do plan on flexing their hours. Human services, health, child support, they will offer hours through 5 o'clock because they do understand that they have clients coming in at those periods of time, and they will be available for that.
Other discussion? Supervisor Burns.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this also include the courts and the law enforcement center?
Yes. In fact, it was really the courts and the law enforcement center that initiated this change, and we felt from an administration standpoint that would be best if all three buildings had the same hour. So, yes, to answer your question.
Thank you, Mr. Ingleson. Who specifically initiated this in that building?
Well, it started with the DA's office and the clerk of courts and all of the judges.
Okay. And what was your reason for wanting to reduce the time by a half hour?
Well, yeah, we're not really reducing.
I'm sorry, I didn't say that correct.
Yes.
You're shifting.
Yes.
Half hour.
They start court at 8:30, or that's the majority of times that they start is at 8:30. And it was felt that from the DA's office and the clerk of courts, the judges wanted those offices open a half hour before court started so that they could prepare for court's cases that were assigned for that day.
Okay, thank you.
Any other discussion? Supervisor Friedland.
What was the department that was not interested in staying later?
A clerk of courts.
Okay, thank you.
Any other discussion? Supervisor Richmond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really feel it's important, at least for the Register of Deeds office and the county clerk's office, to remain open until 5 p.m. There are too many people in the downtown area and the rest of the community that, you know, they work until 4:30 trying to get down and get into the clerk's office. I just think there's a need there. Whether they stagger those hours, that would be great. But, you know, I just think that it needs to be open until 5 o'clock. Whether they stagger, that's fine. But I'd like to see it open with some input maybe from the clerk's office or Register of Deeds office that will state that they are receptive to that staggering of those hours.
Gary?
I guess I can't speak for them. I mean, they're elected offices. We can certainly make that request of them. I guess if the county board makes a motion and it's approved by the county board, we certainly will make them aware of that situation.
I think the challenge for small offices is to stagger, if you only have four or five staff, to stagger coverage to cover 8 to 5, which is, in essence, what we would be asking them to do. And that, I mean, this is what we talked about in executive committee, was that challenge. And so...
So you think it's impossible to stagger?
I think it's a challenge. Maybe the county clerk would like to chime in, since her staff is one of those small staffs that would have to do it.
It wouldn't work in my office. We only have 3 staff members. My office policy requires 2 people to be there at all times. So there's either going to be 2 people there between 8 and 8:30, and 1 person from 4:30 to 5, or vice versa. we handle large sums of cash coming through our office, so it's a safety policy. We require two people to be there at all times, and we just don't have that. We can't.
All right. Thank you. I think we need to have an amendment on there, at least to have the county clerk's office and the registered deeds office open until 5 p.m.
So are you offering an amendment, Supervisor?
I am. I'll make that amendment then.
And will you read it? Will you say it out loud? State the amendment again.
I will make that motion to amend the county clerk's office and the registry of deeds office to be open from 8:30 till 5.
So Supervisor Richmond has offered an amendment that would call for the clerk's office and the register of deeds office to stay open until 5 p.m. So in essence, that would be an exception to these office hour rules. Correct. Is there a second to that? Seconded by Supervisor Burke. So now we are discussing the amendment. Supervisor Richmond, did you want to say anything else since you're the maker of the... Supervisor Geary.
I concur with the amendment. I'd like to add the county treasurer, that 8:30 to 5.
So that's an amendment you're offering?
Sure.
Supervisor Geary is offering an additional amendment that would add the treasurer's office to the clerk's office and the register of deeds office to stay open until 5 p.m. Is there a second to that amendment? Seconded by Supervisor Schrader. Now discussion, first of all, on the Geary amendment, which is just the treasurer's office. We might be repeating ourselves in the debate on several of these, but on the treasurer's office staying open, Supervisor Veenstra.
My question, which is particularly to the treasurer's office, but may affect other offices, is if they mean to increase it till 5 o'clock, but open later at 8:30 in the morning, or open at 8 and be open till 5. In other words, is the amendments are the amendments to open at 8:30 and go till 5?
Correct.
Or they open? Okay. Thanks.
Other discussion on the Geary amendment to have the treasurer's office hours be 8:30 to 5. Discussion on that amendment.
Point of parliamentary procedure. Do we have two amendments on the floor now, or is it just one amendment that we have on the floor?
We have an amendment to the amendment. So I'm referring to this as the Geary amendment. For purposes of helping me, and it's referencing specifically the treasurer's office hours, which the amendment calls for them to be 8:30 to 5. So discussion on that. Supervisor Cruz.
I'm having trouble separating the two amendments, but my comments are going to probably address both of them. I know that we are doing this in order to make things easier for members of the public who would want to use our services, but I think it would be very confusing to members of the public if we had a number of offices within the county that all opened and closed at different times. I don't think we would be doing the public any favors by having that kind of a schedule.
Supervisor Holtz.
I was going to say the same thing, Madam Chair. We're establishing a time frame that the buildings are going to be open, and if it's either 8:30 to 5 or it's 8 to 5 or 4:30, having two or three offices changing the rules, I think is not the way to go. We either stay where we are, or we make the change, and I can't support a hodgepodge.
And just for clarification, this is not necessarily the building being open, which is much longer set of hours. This is the hours of operation, office hours expected, the expectation is that there are staff there to provide the services during office hours. So I just want to clarify, we're not talking about the building being open, but office hours. So we're still on the Geary amendment, which is just the treasurer's office. Any more discussion on that? Supervisor Ebert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I think that I'd like to speak with these folks that it affects, so I'd like to make a motion that we hold over for 30 days so we can talk to the folks that are actually this affects, the clerk of courts, or not the clerk of court, the treasurer and those folks. So my motion.
Supervisor Ebert has made a motion to hold this item over for 30 days. That's been seconded by Supervisor Doyle. Any discussion on holding this over?
Don't expect.
Yeah, I'm not expecting that a lot. Supervisor Hampson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary Engvilson did do a survey of all the involved departments, and the vast majority are happy with the changes that we're making in this ordinance. So I'm not sure we need to hear any more than that. Maybe he could report more on the results of that survey. Thank you.
So the Supervisor Plesha.
I agree with the last three speakers. I guess the problem that I see is if we start hodgepodging, we do have a problem. I think people expect to come to the county and do their business. I think they'll adapt if the change is made. I will defer to Gary for some of his information. I don't know if it was included in your packet or not, but I will also say that the one person I didn't have a chance, I did not go to see the treasurer, but I did go to see the Register of Deeds, and they also told me that people will adapt, and they said that they were happy with the change to go back a half hour because of traffic. Now, something else I think we need to look at is the traffic patterns downtown. If you came here at 5 o'clock, which some people had to, the new supervisors, if you looked out on 4th Street, you saw how busy that street is. It is not a good time to be coming anywhere as far as to the county, for example.
Supervisor Plesha, I'm sorry for the interruption, but we're debating right now whether or not to hold it over.
Thank you. I guess I don't have a problem with holding it over, but I guess I really would like to have something uniform.
So on the motion to hold over for 30 days, that's what we're debating right now. Supervisor Richmond, did you have your hand up for this?
I did. Thank you again, Madam Chair. Definitely feel we should hold this over for 30 days. We're also in the discussion of what hours our committee meeting's going to be. If you're going to close the offices at 4 o'clock and then you're going to have possibly a couple of committee meetings starting later, say at 4 o'clock if it's executive or whatever, then all of a sudden you've got the county clerk's office closed. You've got Registry of Deeds closed. I mean, I really think we need to have more discussion on this. So I'm supporting referral. Thank you.
Supervisor Doyle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support holding this over for 30 days because I have some concerns on the underlying resolution or ordinance. Looking purely from my own perspective as an attorney, I know that a lot of the law offices in town use runners, and a lot of them are high school students, that will do their deliveries at the end of the day, filing things at the clerk of court's office, filing things at the Register of Deeds office. A lot of the banks and the title companies do closings throughout the day, and they want to get those things filed. They need to get those things filed yet that day. And when I hear that the clerk of court's office that has oodles of staff is not willing to flex their hours, that bothers me a lot. And you know, I feel sorry for the smaller ones like Register of Deeds and so forth, but I am concerned if we are going to make these changes that the flow of business in our community that relies upon those two offices in particular, Register of Deeds and the Clerk of Court, plus people who want to come and pay their fine and so forth, I think we need to look at this a little bit further. And I, like Mr. Ebert, would like to talk to, in my case, not so much the departments, but people who are affected by those departments. I'd like to have the Bar Association send something out, for example, asking the members. I'd like to talk to the banks in town and so forth and find out if, in fact, they're going to be affected, because I think they will be. So I support holding it over.
So on referral, any other discussion that we need to have before we can vote on whether or not to hold this over for 30 days? On the computer, everything's going to be on the computer tonight. So on the computer, yes, if you are in favor of holding this over for 30 days. No, if you want to vote on it tonight. This pausing is we're waiting for all votes to come in, just in case anybody's wondering. Sometimes we just like for the room to be quiet, but in this case, it's waiting for a vote. So the ordinance will be held over for 30 days on a vote of 24 in favor of that and 2 opposed. Back to you, Supervisor Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Chair, item 4-17. This would be the second reading of this ordinance as well, an ordinance to amend Section 3.09 of Chapter 3 of the General Code of La Crosse County, Wisconsin, regarding grievance procedures. I move for its approval and ask to retain the floor after a second.
The ordinance Section 3.09 of Chapter 3 regarding grievance procedures has been moved by Supervisor Burke, seconded by Supervisor Brockmiller. Supervisor Burke retains the floor.
At executive committee, an amendment was was ordered to the ordinance. You have it in your packet. It says at the top of it, new amendments. It adds the underlined or by state statute after the word agreement. The first sheet, right after the analysis, on the back it says new amendments at the top. I will give you a chance to find that.
It's printed on the back of the ordinance.
Does everyone see it? All right. On there you'll see underlined, added after agreement or by state statute. Also in that same paragraph, that's paren 1, 3.09, paren 1, addition of in discipline cases involving unpaid suspension or termination, the employee shall have the right to representation by a person of the employee's choosing at the employee's expense at all stages of the grievance procedure, except that the employee's representative shall not be a material witness to the grievance matter. In Section C, in addition, in discipline and termination cases, the county shall have the burden to show just cause for the action. In Section E, or the county was added. I'm sorry, in Section D, after employee or the county was added. And in Section E, after employee or the county was added. I move its approval.
Supervisor Burke moves the amendments as outlined, seconded by Supervisor Brockmiller. Discussion on the amendments. Supervisor Brockmiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to talk a little bit about, I was one of a group of supervisors that met and discussed this along with corporate counsel and Mr. O'Malley and staff. And I wanted to speak a little to what I've seen as a very positive employer-employee relationship in La Crosse County. I would think, I see it for at least the last 10 years. This is my start of my third term, so I've seen it for the entire time I've been on the county board. And a good relationship doesn't mean no disagreements. I think that's impossible. In fact, I think a good relationship warrants some discussion at times, and what we have in La Crosse County is a system, and individuals and groups, employees and employer, that do discuss items, come to the table, do work things out, and we get a lot for that as citizens of La Crosse County and as county board supervisors. We get, for those of you particularly that are new supervisors, you'll come to learn, if you don't already know, that we have some of the best health and human services in the state. Often other counties in the state come to us for advice and counsel and to copy us, to be honest. And the plagiarism is the sincerest form of flattery. And I think those kind of things don't happen by chance. They happen because of both the employer and the employees, the staff that we have in this county. We've came up with many other, including things like our diversion courts, our drug courts, and our OWI courts, and our work on veterans courts. These things, again, don't happen by accident, and they happen because We have employees that are dedicated to the cause, and we have employers that work together to implement services that are better for the County of La Crosse and its residents. Another example I think of is when budget pressures, I'd say perhaps, they're always around, but when they first started to really come on, the county administrator instituted a program on voluntary furlough days. Instead of many other counties in Wisconsin were forced into mandatory furloughs and giving people time off without pay because they just couldn't afford that. And instead, our county, working cooperatively with the employers and the employees, were able to make that work for a long time with voluntary furloughs, perhaps people that were further on in their careers and could afford a little time off, allowing people young and just starting to raise a family to continue to work. It worked well in our workplace in both labor and management, as it's sometimes referred to. I know the administrator also took some unpaid furlough days, so yeah, he was able to lead by example, and because of the workforce we have and the relationship we have with it, that meant something to the workforce we have. I also wanted to talk a little bit about why we have to do this. If you've read your packet, Act 10 requires each county in the state to pass an ordinance to handle grievances of this type. I would hate to see a debate about Act 10. We don't have the authority to change it, so whether we think it's the best law since sliced bread or we think it's horrible, it's not about that law tonight. As a county, we're required to pass an ordinance dealing with grievances and disciplinary matters as we're doing here. I was going to ask if he could, Bob, to come forward. And I was going to ask Bob to actually talk a little bit about his view of what I've said of the labor relationship here and some other counties that didn't extend contracts when there was an opportunity to do so, what they're experiencing now that parts of Act 10 have been, at least at the present, ruled unenforceable, and perhaps a word or two about just cause and Bob's view.
Mr. Tan, if you would introduce yourself and answer Supervisor Brockmiller's questions, please.
Sure. I'm Bob Taunt, the Personnel Director for La Crosse County, and we've been working on collective bargaining stuff for a long time. So to try to address Bill's questions, let me know if I'm going too far afield. We extended contracts for 3 years with all of our union groups except the deputies. So this carries our union contracts from 2011, 2012, 2013. In that period of time, our employees have agreed to pay the employee share of the Wisconsin Retirement Fund, as the governor requested. Also, our self-funded health insurance is less expensive than the state health insurance, so we're ahead on that part as well. There was a 0% wage increase in 2011. There's a 2% in 2012 and a 2% in 2013. So now we have the luxury to sit back and watch as the other counties in the state that have expired labor agreements try to deal with the governance or administration of employees without contracts. The union contract does not belong to the union. The union contract has been negotiated between the county and the union, and they contain a number of rules and organizational pieces that help us just administer all of the things that we do on a daily basis with our employees. So When we look at other counties with union contracts dissolved, there's an absence of rules. People don't know what they're doing. The unions needed to recertify, or they didn't recertify, and there's confusion then what their status is. Union dues were cut off. then there's disputes arising over what can unions bargain in terms of base wage. Other counties are needing to draft handbooks. They're building new pay plans. A lot of the there's several counties that have hired a consultant to at large dollar cost to help them build a new pay plan. They're conducting pay studies. Some of the counties have made poor choices about overtime practices. And now we have a federal court decision that reverses part of Act 10, and it rolls back the union dues, which are allowed to be collected, and it also rolls back annual elections for unions. So what does that mean? What does the union dues authorization mean? Is that mandatory union dues or voluntary union dues? These other counties are scrambling, and they're in the midst of change. There's great uncertainty. But let's talk about the most important piece, which is wages. Remember, we had a 0, a 2, and a 2. Well, the only thing that can be bargained anymore with most of the unions is base wage. They're still arguing over what base wage is, but the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission has come out with some rules for the consumer price index used in determining base wages. For contracts expiring January 1st, 2012, the CPI is 2.01. Okay, not much difference. April 1, 2012, 2.65. July 1, 2012, 3.16. So if we were bargaining contracts today with a termination of mid-year 2012, we could expect the unions to ask for 3.16%. That's the only thing they have left to bargain for. Why wouldn't they ask for the whole thing? So we've avoided all that. Our contracts are looking pretty good in terms of the consumer price index. And we have the option to sit back and watch as the other counties struggle through, and we're waiting for the law to firm up so we know what we're doing.
Supervisor Brockmiller, you still have the floor. I'm not sure if that...
Well, that was very helpful, Bob. Thank you. I wanted to, for those who don't know, wanted to just say a little bit about, I promise I'm not going to talk on and on, but a little bit about what just cause actually means. It's generally defined means a legally sufficient reason for a suspension or a termination. Reason is legally sufficient if it is supported by a preponderance of the evidence. Now, that's a stronger, a higher test, if you will, to meet than arbitrary and capricious or at will, but it's a much lower standard than what would have to be met in a criminal matter, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's somewhere in between, and it seems it's used already in some of the labor agreements that the county has. Some of them use that phrase and what it brings with it. Some of them do not, but it would bring all to that standard, and I can't see where there's anything to argue with if any of us had been accused of doing something wrong, either in life or in the workplace. We would hope for at least the same preponderance of evidence to prove that we did what we did, or did not do what we were accused of. It comes with it things like, is discipline being fairly applied, meaning is the same punishment given for the same infraction, given a similar past history, or are punishments all over the place based on some other non-disciplinary reason, and does the discipline fit the seriousness of the action in this case by the employee, or in a criminal manner for that matter, judges decide whether the crime that was done, they have a sentencing guideline, and they decide based on the severity of the infraction there. So, thank you.
Supervisor Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to speak in favor of the amendment. I think that the grievance procedure as written has two aspects of it that I think most employees would agree to. I think as an employee, probably unfair and unjust discipline is the one thing that employees may fear. And in the grievance procedure, the first, particularly in 3.091, that ability to have someone with you, even from the very first stages of the disciplinary interview, the very first time you might be called in on what you believe is a discipline matter. And I, too, agree with the standard of showing just cause. I think that is it's one of those things that helps to keep the kind of peace within a working force that I think is necessary and has been demonstrated by the experience that we've had in this county. So I support the amendments.
Supervisor Karen Johnson, did you wish to be heard?
Yes, please. Just one second while I figure out. Okay. I just had a question that I'm hoping for clarification on our 417. I'm looking at 3.09 parent A. It's been switched from 7 calendar days to 10 calendar days to report an alleged action. I'm just concerned that chronic tardiness or absence from duties without good cause is being lumped into the same section as sexual harassment in work. And I'd like to hear how recourse would be different, or if it's still 10 days to file for sexual harassment. I think that's a pretty sensitive issue and could possibly be dealt with differently.
Yeah, I'm going to ask that we can definitely discuss that question. It's not germane to the amendment right now. We need to dispose of the amendment, and then we can come back to the ordinance as a whole once we resolve the issue of the amendment. So help me remember that we need to come back to get an answer to that question. So go ahead.
Is that part of the amendment because it's 7 to 10 days, or does that not?
So are you in Section 1A? No. The employee shall first discuss the matter? Is that
yes.
what you're saying? Yeah, that's not. The amendment is just the underlying sections on the sheet that reads new amendments at the top.
Okay, I'm looking maybe at the next sheet at the highlighted section.
Oh. So you're looking at the grayed out area?
Yes.
In the original. So that's the underlying change to the ordinance that is proposed, but we are still talking right now about the amendment, which is the page that has new amendments written at the top.
But is that
an underline?
10 calendar days is my question. Under
we will get there. It's just it's the next layer down.
Okay.
So we need to.
I'll trust.
Good. Trust is.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
We'll get there. So on the Burke amendment, which is the new amendments sheet, Supervisor Geary, is that what you wanted to speak to, was the amendment? You have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When it gets to the county administrator, explain the impartial hearing officer. Do we have a list of people you'd select from, or who do you get for this, or what type of people are these, or...
That's not an amendment, is it? Mr. Supervisor Geary, I'm going to say the same thing.
That's part of the amendment, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's part of the change that's being proposed. But for right now, we're dealing with just the amendment that's labeled 417, new amendments at the top of the page, those items that are underlined only.
Okay. Come back.
And then
to
we'll
me.
Get to, yep, we'll come back to you as well. Maybe. Get any so discussion on the amendment. We're doing everything on the computer. tonight. So on the Burke Amendment, which is, as outlined, as we've said a few times now, the new amendments page labeled 417 in your packet, printed on the back of the analysis page of the ordinance. So these are the amendments to Section 3.09, Parent 1, and then there and C, and D, and E. Everybody know what we're voting on? This is just that amendment. On the computer, yes if you are in favor, no if you are opposed. That amendment has passed on a 26-0 vote, and the chair is ruling that that is a major or significant amendment to this ordinance. So it significantly changes it. So that means that actually tonight is the first reading of now this amended amendment to the ordinance. So that leaves us a couple of options, just reminding everybody that our county board rules state that we can discuss anything in the amended ordinance two times tonight, and again the second time. We also have the option, if this group so chooses, to suspend the rules and do both readings tonight. But I believe that the amendment that just passed is a significant change to what originally came before us. So now discussion on the amended amendment, with Mr. Lang clearing the way for us here. But go ahead.
If I can, just because it's major, it gets referred to the next meeting, so it becomes in effect the first consideration again. But if you want it done today, then you have to do a 2/3 vote of the supervisors present to say we want to consider it today amended. And then you can finish it today if you don't want it referred to the next meeting. Same as suspending the rules.
So back to now Supervisor Karen Johnson on her question on the amended amendment.
So I'd just like to re-ask my question. Can I just get some clarification on the 10 days piece from whoever?
Mr. Lang.
Yeah. I'm not sure why. Mr. Talent and I both worked on this, and I think it was just giving a little bit more time on. And I think that was just giving a little bit more time on that from the time that was on there. I think it had five and...
it was seven previously.
Right. So it was discussed the matter within 7 days, so it was changed to be 10 calendar days, because then that would be two full weeks. 10 calendar days would be a little bit more time. And then give it a little bit more time where it's not resolved to 7 calendar days, because it was 5 working days, so... It's not a big difference.
My question is, on top of that, that makes sense. But so we're treating something in the workplace like chronic tardiness and sexual harassment with the same 10-day mark. So
you're right. Any grievance, if you're talking about, it could be tardiness. It could be something for termination. Right. Any type of discipline action. And maybe Bob can answer why that we've done that, because we've had this type of policy or something similar for quite a while.
Again, this is the grievance of the discipline. It's not
right.
The action.
Right.
Just to clarify, this is... Go ahead, Dave. This is a...
I, as a former personnel director, I was just going to, this is the grievance by the employee who was accused of whatever the act was, grieving the discipline that's already happened. This does not affect taking someone out of harm's way. Your concern is well put that tardiness is much different from sexual aggression or some other more severe, but we will, as the employer, have already interjected and taken the person out of harm's way. This is about the employee grieving the disciplinary action and how much time you have to actually address that. Whether the person's guilty or not is a process then that the person is grieving the action of the employer.
Okay. Thank you. Supervisor Geary.
Back to that question, the county administrator would appoint an impartial hearing officer. Who are these impartial hearing? Where do they come from?
Well, I'd ask Bob to weigh in on it a little bit, but our intention would be, since we haven't done this before, is we'd first of all rely on Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission. As long as that continues to provide avenues for people that specialize in being independent examiners, independent administrative law judges, so to speak, they do this as a matter of course. Currently under a union contract, the two parties actually strike from a list, and that's pretty standard practice. There are other people that do this as work, mediators, attorneys, that type of thing, but we would always be erring on the side of trying to get somebody that is truly independent because that builds a stronger case if we need to be upheld if it were to go to litigation.
Okay, that's good. I like the amendment they have, except I don't like the very last one. Final appeal shall be to the county board. I don't think the county board should be getting involved in grievance procedures when the person, him or her, that was disciplined, it went to their supervisor, it went to the personnel director, then the county administrator picked somebody off this list.
Mr. O'Malley will explain why we don't have a choice in that matter.
Can I
understand? Or Dave will.
I don't either, but that's what the law, what the change in Act 10 provides. It provides three things, and one of them is final appeal shall be to the governing body of the agency.
My only comment about that, I guess we'll comply with the law then. But
that would be good.
Although we do have a lovely new jail across the road.
Even though I don't concur with it, but nothing good could occur if the county board overturned a decision that was upheld by the supervisor, the personnel director, somebody from the WERC that specializes in this. It obviously wouldn't be done on the merits. It'd be some kind of political decision, but it wouldn't obviously be done by the merits if we ever overturned it after that many hoops.
Supervisor Schrader.
Thank you. Mine's a question on 3.09 under grievance procedures, and it's the last underlined sentence. Detailed rules and procedures consistent with this section shall be outlined in a separate document and approved by the executive committee. Does that go anyplace from the executive committee, or it stops there? What happens there?
I guess it does stop there, Jeff, and it is included in the packet. There's a part grievance procedure. It's a little bit more detailed because instead of specifying everything in the ordinance, we could have done that, but in talking with Mr. Talent, the personnel director, felt it might be better to have a working document that's actually fairly simple to follow but a little more detailed than the ordinance.
Okay, I just thought maybe everybody would get to review that, but not.
Supervisor Veenstra.
Thanks. This question is more for Mr. Lang. I think with regard to the concern that Mr. Geary had about the review by the county board, I did note that it indicates that the review would be just of the record from the hearing that's held in front of the impartial judge or whatever you want to call him. Is there any standard of review like that the county board would have, or would it have essentially the right to make whatever decision it wanted? Because I know that normally when you're just reviewing a record of something that was produced by some other hearing, it's essentially only if they made a serious mistake of law that you're allowed to overturn the decision. And I guess I'm curious about that. Does the Act require anything?
It doesn't, and we did address it in the policy that's a little bit more detailed. It's in your packet under WIS Act 32 grievance policy and procedure. And at the end of that, that's why we didn't have all the details in the ordinance. It does indicate that, you know, the appeal is just a review of the record. It's not a new hearing. The executive committee is going to look at it first. So for both the executive committee and the board, the review is limited. It's limited to whether the impartial hearing officer kept within its jurisdiction, whether it proceeded on the correct theory of law. These are things that, as attorneys even know, are very limited scopes of review, so that, in other words, you can't just go in and say, we don't like this. You know, it's a very limited scope of review, and our office would be also advising the executive committee and the board on the same thing, that, hey, look, you know, unless there's something we can find that's really wrong here, you can't just substitute your judgment and overturn this.
Supervisor Holtz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was along the same line as Supervisor Schrader. I was questioning the fact that the other refinements don't come back to this body. I was curious about that. And you're saying they're attached, and I'm looking at these, and I'm not positive I'm reading what the attached, which are those rules, I guess, that you're saying we already have a copy of. That's the Act 32 part?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I guess I don't have a serious question that they're here, but Supervisor Schrader already asked it. Thank you.
Any other debate? Supervisor Geary.
Well, Dave, if you read this thing, the way you explained what we reviewed isn't the way this thing is worded. It says the executive committee and our county board may affirm in full or in part, reverse in full or in part, or modify the impartial hearing officer decision. The decision of the county board is final and non-appealable. The way this is worded, we can change it, reverse it, modify it, or do anything we want with it, unless you get some more wording in there that, you know, clarifies it.
Yeah, you can. Otherwise, why have the review? So you have to have the ability. But the paragraph just before that shows how your review is limited.
How can we be limited when we can just reverse it?
Well, you can, but you have to find that the impartial hearing officer either didn't keep within their jurisdiction or was in a...
Where does it say that?
Right above it. It's right above that.
You mean...
The board's review is limited to, see that, whether the IHO kept within its jurisdiction, whether proceeding on the correct theory of law. And it's also, it's just based upon the record. It's not based on any additional evidence.
Fine. We think he did something wrong. Even though he didn't do anything wrong, we can say he did something wrong when we reviewed the record. And that's not appealable.
We're complying with the law.
Right?
Well, it is as it is. I mean, the standard is limited, but, you know, you have to, you know, the board, the executive committee, and the board would make its decision. All I'm just saying is I would be advising the committee and the board, this is your standard of review, which is a limited standard of review.
Right. I mean, then you make the decision and it's not appealable, but I think that's the best we can do.
So remember, this is the now considered the first reading of this amended ordinance. So any other discussion tonight, we can, county board rules allow us to debate this both times, both readings. Anything else for debate for tonight? Supervisor Doyle.
I just have a minor administrative matter. When I look at the policy where the additions are, those are underlined and the subtractions are crossed out. When you look at the ordinance, you've got highlights, which is not normally the way that we see things. Usually when I see something highlighted, it's an addition. So when it's highlighted and it's a subtraction, my little brain gets kind of tangled up. So can we follow consistently with the normal procedure would be like it's listed in these policies here. If we can follow that procedure, I think it's less confusing. If you would do that, please.
So noted.
Thank you.
Yeah. I guess our ordinance has a specific language.
Any other discussion? If not, is that it for you, Supervisor Burke?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Health and Human Services Board, Supervisor Hampson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have item 418,
to the honorable members of the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors. Request Wisconsin Department of Health Services to do a health impact assessment of frac sand mining on public health. Therefore, be it resolved that the La Crosse County Board does hereby encourage Governor Walker, Senator Schilling, Representatives Doyle and Billings, and the Wisconsin Counties Association to support requiring the Wisconsin Department of Health Services to conduct a health impact assessment of frac sand mining hazards and to develop recommendations for actions to protect public health if needed. Fiscal note, there is no county cost to the County of La Crosse with passage of this resolution. I move for its approval.
Supervisor Hansen has moved approval of the resolution, seconded by Supervisor Cruz. Discussion on the resolution. I'm going to be brave here and trying to do a voice vote. All those in favor of the resolution signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The resolution is approved. Thank you. Anything else from you, Supervisor Hampson?
No, ma'am.
If not, Planning, Resources, and Development Committee, I believe that Supervisor Tina Weirs will be reading these.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have item 4-19. Which is zoning petition number 1887 to amend the La Crosse County zoning ordinance filed by Stanley Dwyer to rezone from exclusive agricultural district to Ag District A for continued residential use of two existing homes in the town of Washington. The committee unanimously recommended approval of this petition with two conditions, and I move for the approval.
Supervisor Weirs moves the committee report, seconded by Supervisor Kyle. Discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That is approved.
I have item 4-20, zoning petition number 1888 to amend the La Crosse County zoning ordinance filed by Sean O'Flaherty, acting on behalf of Skipperliner Acquisitions, LLC, to rezone from residential district C to industrial district for additional parking of vehicles and boats in the town of Campbell. The committee unanimously approved recommended approval of this petition with no conditions, and I move for the approval.
Supervisor Weirs moves the committee report, which is to approve, seconded by Supervisor Schrader. Discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. That is approved.
Item 4-21, zoning petition number 1889 to amend the La Crosse County zoning ordinance filed by Ronald E. and Susan J. Anderson to rezone from exclusive agriculture district to Agriculture District A for continued residential use in the town of Burns. The committee unanimously recommended approval with two conditions, and I move for the approval.
Supervisor Weirs moves the committee report, which is to approve, seconded by Supervisor Kyle. Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That is approved.
Item 4-22, zoning petition number 1891 to amend the La Crosse County ordinance zoning ordinance filed by Edward A. Jr. and Diane K. Iserman to rezone from exclusive agriculture district to agriculture district A for continued residential use and to allow for two additional residences in the town of Holland. The committee unanimously recommended approval with one condition, and I move for the approval.
Supervisor Weirs moves the committee report, which is to approve, seconded by Supervisor Kyle. Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That is approved.
Item 4-23, zoning petition number 1892 to amend the La Crosse County zoning ordinance filed by Fred Hayen, acting on behalf of Dorothy Seab and Maynard and Kathleen Tauscher to rezone from exclusive agriculture district to agricultural district A for continued residential use and agricultural use in the town of Bangor. The committee unanimously recommended approval with two conditions, and I move for the approval.
Supervisor Weirs moves the committee report, which is to approve, seconded by Supervisor Kyle. Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That petition is approved.
Item 4-24, zoning petition number 1893 to amend the La Crosse County zoning ordinance filed by Chris Fechner, acting on behalf of Dennis Groenbeck, to rezone from transitional agriculture district to agriculture district A to allow for a single family residence in the town of Holland. The committee recommended unanimously recommended approval with two conditions, and I move for the approval.
Supervisor Weirs moves the committee report, which is to approve, seconded by Supervisor Kyle. Discussion on this. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That petition is approved.
Item 4-25, zoning petition number 1894 to amend the La Crosse County zoning ordinance filed by Leon H. and Ruth Paff to rezone from exclusive agricultural district to agricultural district A, approximately 27 acres, for sale of the existing farmhouse and farm buildings and to sell three proposed residential lots in the town of Farmington, and to rezone from the exclusive district agriculture district to transitional agriculture district, approximately 128 acres in the town of Farmington. The PRD committee unanimously recommended approval with two conditions, and I move for the approval.
Supervisor Weers moves the committee report, seconded by Supervisor Kyle. I will note on this that Supervisor Leon Paff, who is the petitioner in this, absented him, left the room, so he was not present at the time of this discussion. Just a reminder to supervisors that if you are wanting, if you have a conflict of interest on an issue, that's an appropriate measure to take. So Supervisor Paff left the room before this item was discussed. Well, maybe we aren't going to discuss it. Is there any discussion on this item? Supervisor Geary.
Well, on the 128 acres going from exclusive ag to transitional ag, I thought it was difficult to rezone exclusive ag. What does this allow that property to be done that isn't being done currently? I assume it's all farmland right now.
We'll ask that the interim zoning director be heard on this, Mr. Nathan Sampson.
That's correct, Supervisor Geary. These are both farmland preservation zoning districts, so the reason for zoning from one farmland preservation district to another was a recommendation from the town to apply deed restrictions to the balance of the acreage. When the original zoning petition was made, those parts of that property that weren't to be, that were proposed to be deed restricted, weren't the subject of the petition. So Supervisor Paff refiled a petition to include all acreage so that deed restrictions could be placed on the newly zoned transitional ag property.
Well, what kind of restrictions?
Condition number one is the deed restriction.
Is that it for you, Supervisor Geary? Any other discussion on this petition? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That petition is approved as well. Nate, if you would let Supervisor Paff know that he can come back, please. Thank you. Anything else for you, Supervisor Weers? Let's see if you can follow in that same speed and track record, Supervisor Burns, with Public Works and Infrastructure.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Item 4-26, to the honorable mention, or to the honorable members of the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors, regarding authorization to sell unimproved parcel to City of La Crosse. Whereas La Crosse County has acquired title to certain property in the City of La Crosse pursuant to tax foreclosure action, and now therefore be resolved that the La Crosse County Board hereby authorizes sale of parcel 17-50308-78 to the City of La Crosse for payment of the outstanding taxes against the property. Be it further resolved that the county board chair and county clerk are authorized to sign a quit claim deed conveying this property to the City of La Crosse upon approval by the Corporation Council. Fiscal note, the total amount owing, including interest and penalties, as of March 2012 is $36.19. The committee voted this unanimously, 6-0. I move for its approval.
Supervisor Burns moves approval of the resolution, seconded by Supervisor Spiker. Discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That resolution is approved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Resolution 4-27, to the honorable members of the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors, regarding approval of easement to City of La Crosse to construct and maintain a recreation trail at the La Crosse County landfill site. Whereas the La Crosse County Landfill Master Plan use plan promotes walking trails and recreational activities as part of the long run plan for the La Crosse County landfill property, and now therefore be resolved that the La Crosse County Board hereby approves the conveyance of an easement to the City of La Crosse for the purpose of constructing and maintaining a recreation trail as indicated on the attached map. Be it further resolved that the La Crosse County Board Chair is hereby authorized to execute any documents to convey the easement to the City of La Crosse after approval of Corporation Council. Fiscal note, City of La Crosse will be responsible for construction and maintenance of the trail. The committee did approve this on a 6-0 vote. and I move for its approval.
Supervisor Burns moves approval, seconded by Supervisor Cruz. Discussion? Supervisor Schrader.
When we give the city of La Crosse an easement to something like this, can that easement be withdrawn?
Mr. Lang?
Well, the easement will be to construct this trail. So I don't think we're, you know, at this point in time, we'll still own the property, but the city will have the easement to construct it and maintain it. How long the easement will be for, I think we haven't really determined that. But the primary reason for this is to construct the trail. So,
well, just so that it won't impede our operations out there if they extend beyond what they are originally.
Yeah, I think Hank is here. If that's a question, Hank could probably answer that.
Mr. Cook, if you would introduce yourself to the board and answer Mr. Schrader's question, please.
Sorry, I was asking about the location, so I can repeat the question.
Good evening. My name is Henry Cook. I am your director of the Solid Waste Department. I'm a professional engineer, and I'm the guy that you'll come to know as the person that loves garbage. Supervisor Schrader, I did not hear your full question. Could you re-ask it, please?
I'll try. by granting the city of La Crosse an easement, and if in the future we find out that we need this land for our operations, how hard will it be for us to break that easement? Is it in our best interest to put a time limit on that easement or renewal dates on it? I have no idea.
If I could have Jenny pull up an air photo of the site, two things, I want to break them apart. The first one is that the easement that we are granting is our property line right here, and our easement would be right along that property line. This is a wetland here. It would not be suitable for us to do any development in this area. So the potential that we would ever want to look at that property for development associated with the landfill is very low, might be actually impossible with the DNR. So this is a good place to allow walking trails and other things in it. On the same token, if something came up in the future and we said that land is valuable to us and we need it for some operational activity at the site, then we may have to negotiate with the city and say we have an alternative location for your trail on the property, and we would have to look at switching it. If we did that, then they might say, well, we invested money in the trail. Will you reestablish the trail in this alternative location? I think we could have a very positive discussion. The city of La Crosse and the county on this have been very collaborative, so I feel this is a very low risk to the county.
That it for you, Mr. Schrader. Supervisor Ebert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, when it says it, the indicator on the attached map, it would be nice if the attached map was here.
Yes, it would.
Is that the whole thing, Hank, or does it go? I just have no clue. And you can just let that softball go.
No, the committee saw a map, correct? Committee, I'm looking at the committee leadership, yes? Okay. Yeah, there should have been a map attached. Apologies.
I mean, is it 10 acres or is it 20 acres or is it where do I?
It's a 50. It is a 50-foot strip that runs along approximately 2,000 feet of the edge of our property.
And that's the southern edge?
That is the western edge.
On the road part? On the Highway 16?
Okay. This is the entrance to our landfill. This is the road going out to 16, so north is in this direction towards the top of the map. The trail would start here. Our property line is approximately here, so the trail would start between the pine trees and the edge of our property line. It goes along this these trees. This is the westerly portion of our property. If we can go to the next map. Those trees end here. Our property then angles to the southwest. This is behind Stansfield's vending here. It goes to this corner here. Our property then goes due south along here, and it's behind the building that has been recently rented out to the new truck place. The length of this property along here is slightly more than 2,000 feet. We're looking at providing an easement in the 50 feet right along the edge of the property for this trail.
And is there a trailhead at the other end, or what's at the other end of this?
The City of La Crosse's plan for this year is to develop the trail from 16 to this point and come out on this preliminarily developed trail that they put on their property already. Their plan then is in the following year to come in and develop the next section of trail along the remainder of that side.
Thank you very much. And again, it's kind of a bad deal. Thank you.
Supervisor Richmond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had some questions on the same questions that Supervisor Ebert had asked, but a question, does La Crosse County, being it's the master plan, do they promote any other walking trails? Are you aware? I have the question, and I don't know if it was asked at Public Works, where the city is going to be responsible for construction and maintenance of the trail. What are those costs? Did anybody ask those costs at Public Works? Was that brought up at all? Any discussion? Here it is. The City of La Crosse taxpayers are going to foot the bill again for any maintenance, future maintenance and construction. I almost think it should be a shared cost, but I don't know if those questions were asked at the meeting. Nobody can answer
that. To my knowledge, those questions were not asked at the meeting. I've had discussions with the City of La Crosse on the maintenance and construction costs of the city. They indicated to me that monies have been budgeted. Monies are in the current budget this year to construct the initial portion of the trail. We discussed the maintenance of the trail. They felt that they have some existing maintenance people that are doing lawn cuttings or grass cuttings and other things. We also explored the option with the City of La Crosse that in the future we would like to enlist Eagle Scouts and some other groups to help with the maintenance of the trails. And there's been a couple groups that have come forward. Silent Sports and Human Powered Trails have come forward. So I would hope that once the trail is developed, once it has been stabilized, that we could get other groups that would help the city with the maintenance of that trail.
And I certainly would like to see that to lower the tax burden, I guess. Thank you.
Supervisor Burns.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify, Ms. Cook, this trail is on the outside perimeter of our landfill operation. It is not going to interfere with any daily operations of our landfill, and it's in the unsecured portion of our landfill.
You are correct. This will not interfere with any operations in the landfill. We have security fencing on the other side of the pine trees, and we have security fencing throughout this area so that while it is unsecured, people cannot go across the 8-foot chain link and enter the landfill operations area or the area where we have closed facilities.
Thank you.
Supervisor Schrader.
Hank, refresh my memory here. Is the City of La Crosse providing any parking for this trail?
At this time, the parking is going to be limited to street side.
So that won't impede anything that's happening at the landfill? I guess that's what I'm getting at here.
I've been out there, and the City of La Crosse has already developed an unimproved trail right here. You can see it. And I've noticed people that are using it are primarily from the industrial park. And at this point in time, I don't think the plans are to openly advertise this for heavy use until more of the trail has developed and trailheads can be secured. There were locations in the master land use plan that suggested future locations for trailheads on the property.
Any other discussion? On the resolution, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The resolution is approved. Back to you, Supervisor Burns.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Resolution 4-28 to the honorable members of the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors regarding authorization to sell unimproved parcel to Village of West Salem. Whereas La Crosse County has acquired title to certain property in the Village of West Salem pursuant to a tax foreclosure action, and now therefore be resolved that the La Crosse County Board hereby authorizes the sale of the parcel to the Village of West Salem for payment of the outstanding taxes, interest, and penalty against said property. Be it further resolved that the County Board Chair and County Clerk are authorized to sign a quit claim deed conveying this property to the Village of West Salem upon approval by Corporation Council. Fiscal note, the total amount owing as of March 2012 is $2,911.26, consisting of unpaid general property taxes in the amount of $2,095.52, unpaid interest penalties in the amount of $665.74, and tax foreclosure costs in the amount of $150. The resolution passed on a unanimous vote by the committee. I move for its approval.
Supervisor Burns moves approval of the resolution, seconded by Supervisor Schrader. Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The resolution is approved.
Okay, finally, we have item 4-29 to the honorable members of La Crosse County Board of Supervisors regarding approval of bids for the sale of property taken by tax foreclosure. Whereas La Crosse County has advertised for the sale of approximately 11 separate parcels of property which were subject to a prior tax foreclosure action, and now therefore be resolved that the La Crosse County Board shall hereby sell the parcels for which a responsive bid was accepted by the Public Works and Infrastructure Committee, with the requirement that the contingencies in the bid for the two parcels indicated on the back be met with 6 months of passage of this resolution. Be it further resolved that the La Crosse County Board Chair and County Clerk are hereby authorized to execute any documents necessary to accomplish the sale of said properties after approval of Corporation Council. Fiscal note, the revenue from tax delinquent property is first used to satisfy outstanding taxes. Any remaining revenue is receipted to the current fiscal year in the Treasury's Department. This resolution passed on a 6-0 vote, and I move for its approval.
Supervisor Burns moves approval of the resolution, seconded by Supervisor Paff. Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That resolution is approved as well. Thank you, Supervisor Burns. Is that it for you?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Before we, before I'll entertain a motion to adjourn, any suggestions for future agenda items? I know it's been a long evening for all of us, extra long for those who are new supervisors. Thanks of the chair for sticking with us. Supervisor Geary.
Doesn't have to be next month, but maybe in the next 3 or 4 months, Dave wants to give us an update, probably to be in closed session, about some ongoing litigation. We've got some cases dangling out there that maybe new supervisors aren't aware of, and you know, in 3-4 months, brief update on what's going on.
Any other suggestions for future agenda items? And again, before I entertain a motion to adjourn, I would just ask that supervisors stay seated once we're adjourned so that the clerk can remind everyone of the procedures for logging off the computers, which is our responsibility and not that of the clerk to have to come around and clean up after us, please. So with that request having been made, I would entertain a motion to adjourn, moved by Supervisor Richmond, seconded by Supervisor Brockmiller. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. We are adjourned with the thanks of the chair.